Okay, we're back here for part two with the star that is Kevin Kennedy.
All right, pal.
So we were just literally chatting just before I pressed record that we couldn't remember exactly where we left off.
I think we were up to where Stephen Frears, where he let me stay on the set to learn an awful lot about filmmaking. And then I met him again on an aeroplane. I was going out to Nashville and he walked past me. And he stopped, came back and said, "You're one of my actors, aren't you?" Which I thought was double cool.
Yeah.
And as I say, this was all before Corrie, but pretty much straight after that, I was doing another play for the BBC down in Cardiff.
Okay.
Called Keep On Running, which was about Manchester Grammar School in the 50s, I think it was. 50s, 60s.
Right.
And it was cool, but I didn't want to do it at first. But all my mates were in it. All my pals from youth theatre and in the profession, who are in the profession now, were in it. So he said, do you want to come and do it? It's only three scripted lines, but I'll give you pretty much carte blanche. You can be in any scene you want. Because I was playing this guy called Pete, who was the school lunatic.
Okay.
Right. Who was really mad.
Yeah.
It kept hanging effigies of the teachers everywhere.
Yeah.
So I said, okay. So I went down and did that. And whilst I was doing that, Granada got in touch with me and said, would you come up for an audition to play Curly Watts? I said...
So they got in touch with you?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, they got in touch with my agent at the time. And I said, I can't at the minute because I'm actually shooting this thing for the BBC. And they said, well, could you make it on such and such a date? I said, that date will be good. Yeah, yeah. And anyway, so we're shooting this thing. And then my friend Nick Conway, who played Billy in Bread, I've known him for a long time. He caught meningitis before the shoot was over. So we had to reshoot stuff. So I had to ring Granada, or my agent ring Granada, so we can't make it on that date. And they're going, oh, can you make it up on this date? It's a Sunday. I said, yeah, well, I'll do that. So we finished the shooting. I got up very early on a Sunday morning after a heavy night after the rap party, got on the train from Cardiff up to Manchester, went in, read for it, and I don't think I'd left the building, and my agent rang. It was on a Sunday as well, saying, right, you start tomorrow.
Amazing.
So that was my first introduction. So it was very quick. I turned up on the Monday morning, and what I loved about this particular gig is because up to then I'd just been a jobbing actor, and Coronation Street didn't hold the kind of power it did for me like it does nowadays.
Yeah, and yeah, yeah.
It was just the great thing about that was it was a home gig, which meant I didn't have to pay rent, and my mum did the washing and everything.
Yeah.
So which was great. So I got there and I was booked for a couple of weeks. But there was a week in the middle where I wasn't working, so I went to sign on, as you do. I did the first episode, which was the whole point of bringing in Curly was to, it was a vehicle for get another actor out called Chalky Whiteley, who needed to go to Australia to see his family. And they needed someone to come up with a brainy bin man who, because he works on the bins, to come up with an accumulator on the betting to get this guy to America, to Australia, sorry. Purely as a device to get this guy who could write the betting accumulator on the horses, the brainy bin man, put it all together for him so we could get the money to go to Australia.
So he wasn't necessarily supposed to be like this long-term mainstay character?
No, he was just in for four episodes to do this. So I shot the first two episodes and that was cool, working with Jeff Hughes, God bless his soul, Eddie Yates. And I worked. My first scene was with Barbara Knox, Rita Fairclough, and it was all very exciting and it was cool. And the next week I went to sign on and... You you get to the desk and the woman's there. She's going, have you been working? I said, yeah, I worked last week. What did you work on? I said, I worked on Coronation Street. And there was a bit of a silence. What? I said, well, as an actor, I've just finished two episodes, but I'm not working this week, but I'll be working again next week. So I need to sign on for this week. And that's when the first time I ever saw the power of Coronation Street.
Yeah.
Her attitude completely changed.
Yeah.
Oh! Come here, look at A, he's on Coronate, and all this stuff. And my claim was back in the next day, so it was pretty cool. And that's what started it, really. And then I went off. So I did those four episodes, and then I went off and did another job that we talked about it before. I went off to do Hamlet, and I did Hamlet and met up with Johnny Marr and the Smiths and all that. Came back, did a few more episodes, and then I did another job called No Sex Please, We're British, which was a massive farce, a massive hit in the West End, and it was the first tour it ever done.
Yeah.
And I took over from Andrew Sachs, who played Manuel in
Fawlty Towers. Yeah.
And we actually came here to this theatre where we're sat now in Sunderland Empire. And meanwhile, Granada were going, well, we need him for episodes. And my agents are going, well, you know, he's working here. So eventually they had to put me on a contract. The contract then was all inclusive. You couldn't do anything else. And that was the start of it. And so I started, and I started in Coronation Street, and I to cut 20 years into a very short kind of period, I started as the Bins, and I moved in with Emily Bishop, which was a joy. Eileen Derbyshire is an absolutely diamond of a woman, a great actress, and very, very funny. And then I moved into probably my favourite place of all time, which was the Duckworths.
Yeah.
And I lived at the Duckworths for quite a while. And I love that set. I love Bill Tarmy and Liz Dawn. What I loved about them is they were so humble. They didn't realize just how good they were.
Yeah.
They had no idea just how funny, how creative, and iconic they were. Because they started off as extras, you know, and then they grew into these parts. And that set was mad, because everything was done at 1,000 miles an hour. And a million decibels.
Right.
And Bill and Liz, God bless them, they didn't have the technique of learning lines. So it means they wrote little notes everywhere, all over the place.
No way.
So I was doing a breakfast scene with them once, and it was as an actor, a trained actor, you know.
Yeah.
I went to reach for the cornflakes, and Bill Tarmy says, "Hey, son, don't touch that." I said, "Why? What's that, Bill?" "It's got the lines on it." Oh, all right, thanks, Bill. And then I went to get the milk or something, and Liz went, hey, leave that alone. I said, why? She says, it's got my lines on it.
Brilliant.
And that's how we worked in that set. And the thing is, this is not a criticism of them, because they made that work.
They were brilliant.
And they were absolutely brilliant. And I had a great time
there. Yeah.
So moving on, then I moved into... on my own into Rita's old house, and we got into that big saga of the Raquel and Des Barnes stuff, mm-hmm. with lots of other little adventures in between. And whilst that was running as well, with the Des Barnes thing and the Raquel, we were doing the high comedy stuff with Ken Morley as Reg Holdsworth. Uh-huh. So I had the best of all worlds. So I was playing this high comedy,
so much to do.
High comedy stuff, you know, which people really enjoyed.
Yeah.
Very, very, very funny, because I love working with Ken Morley. He's a comic genius. He's completely mental, but he's a comic genius. And plus playing this heavy drama of Curly being lovelorn and what have you. And everything was great, you know.
Mm.
And it was brilliant. But around that time as well, I got into... heavy addiction stuff. You know, I was drinking far too much, using drugs and all sorts of stuff, which came to a head. I had a band as well. I was playing with a band called The Bunch of Thieves, who were not so much a recording band. We were just a heavy drinking country band. And we played at the Mean Fiddler, and we played at the Reading Festival, and it was like seven musicians. They weren't as bad as me, but we were all heavy drinkers, and wrote really good stuff, all kind of original stuff. But to cut a very long story short, I ended up into rehab, and it was pretty awful time. Came out of rehab.
This is all while you were still
in Coronation. Yeah, well, Coronation Street were brilliant. They sent me off for 6 months, so you got to sort yourself out.
Yeah.
Which I did do, thank God. You know, and I started, really started everything again. My whole life changed. It was around that time I went to Nashville as well for the first time, and I went there with a pal of mine called Stan the Man from Didsbury, who is he's about 6'4", completely bald, and likes to wear bright orange or bright yellow suits. And we went there for a photo shoot, but we ended up getting a residency at a place called Tootsie's Orchid Lounge, which is just outside the Ryman Auditorium. Nice. And the story goes, I mean, you come out the stage door and there's Tootsie's, and they used to, people like Hank Williams used to go in there and what have you. And when they didn't have any money, they would put their songs behind the bar. So, and Tootsie would take them, and she'd lend them money for drinks and food and what have you. Right. And then when they got the money back, or when they had money, then they'd buy the songs back. So at one point, Tootsie was in there. She had all the rights to My Cheating Heart and the rest of it. And it was quite a fascinating place.
Yeah.
But me and my mate get there, and the first thing we saw as we walked in the door was this sign, which says, "All firearms must be handed in at the door." This is a proper honky-tonk. And this is like in the middle 80s. And it was quite a rough old area. It was Nashville, downtown Nashville. It was pretty naughty. And me and my mate, we were playing down there, you know. And they were just looking at us. And they liked what we were doing, but they couldn't work out how these two blokes from England had come across and was singing country songs, especially one who's bald and got a great big, you know, yellow suit on, and this little one with glasses. So it was kind of weird. But that trip changed everything for me, because I suddenly realised the wealth and the experience and the way country music is put together in Nashville, and just how important Nashville was.
Mm.
And that became very important, and I went back again numerous times. So there I was, I mean, I'm sober, playing in Nashville, having a good time. And I came back, and I was right in the middle of the very heavy stuff for Raquel and everything. And that storyline, which was beautifully written and beautifully acted by my two colleagues. And Simon Cowell at the time had a massive hit with the two guys from Soldier Soldier. And he was looking for another kind of vehicle for that, a TV-led vehicle. But I knew he didn't like soaps, and I knew he wasn't too keen on Coronation Street. So what I did, we got one of our songs called Bulldog Nation, and we sent it down to him under a pseudonym. Right. We didn't tell him who it was. We just sent him the song
because you knew he'd just dismiss it.
I knew he'd just dismiss it. And I ended up going down there with another friend of mine, and we got to the hotel where Simon was, and he was very good, actually. I like Simon. And he said, another lady called Denise Baton, who worked for BMG, and he said, right, okay, I like what you've done, let's sign it. So I was signed, and I was signed to BMG. We waited around for quite a while we got the thing released, and eventually we got it released. And to be fair, it didn't do very well. I think it came in at it got in the top 50, but it was wedged between Madonna and Jerry Halliwell, which is, I've been wedged in worse places, I suppose. And that kind of had a ripple effect. A lot of people liked it, but didn't say they like it.
Right.
Because it was a guitar-led music in a predominantly dance chart.
Yeah.
And a lot of people who've since come up to me and go, I really liked it, but I couldn't say anything, you know, because you had that soapism.
Because everyone, obviously once it was released, everyone knew it was you.
Yeah, and everyone was doing, all the soap guys were doing songs, which is absolutely fine. I've got no qualms with that. But they wouldn't admit to liking it. But a lot, as I say, a lot of people have come up and said that, and we really liked it. I was dropped by BMG, and then Warner Brothers turned up and said, we really like it. And we'd gone ahead and finished the album anyway. Because we pulled in loads of favours, we recorded it in my mate's studio, and we'd done the whole album. Because we didn't trust BMG to say, okay, we like this. And we just wanted to finish the album. And if and when they turned around and said, okay, we love it, it's done, it's a success, we want an album now. I said, well, go, here you are, it's done.
Yeah.
And it was the album was a mixture of original songs and a few traditional stuff dust only. And we got Scott Gorham from Thin Lizzy to do the lead on Whiskey in the Jar, which was on the album.
Okay.
And the album did very well, and in Australasia and around there. We went gold in New Zealand and things that, which led to other stuff. When they said, "Well, the album's done really well. It's gone gold, and there's country people want to see you in America and in Nashville again, and in Memphis, and they want." I got invited to play the River Fest in I think it's Arkansas or Arkansas. I can't remember. Really deep down in the South, and on that bill was Hank Williams Jr. and Willie Nelson and Steve Earle and me. So I was right at the bottom, you know. I was just brought in as a kind of curiosity thing, but I got to go and I got to play. And but this is where the mixture of the two worlds were quite crazy. I remember I was filming an episode of Coronation Street, which consisted of it's a Roundheads and Cavaliers story, where we all dressed up as Roundheads and Cavaliers doing like war games,
right?
And we filmed that in this park near in Withenshaw, where I was born, where I was brought up. And I was filming that on a Friday afternoon, dressed as a Roundhead. As soon as that was finished, I went to Manchester Airport and I flew into Atlanta, Georgia. So I got picked up from Georgia, and then driven through the night in like half asleep. And I found myself playing at Morgan Freeman's Blues Club in Mississippi.
Yeah.
Deep down in, I think it's Clarksville or Clarksdale, something like that. It's right on the Mississippi. You open the stage door, and there is the Mississippi. And it's like a mile wide, you know. It's like, and this place was unreal. So I was doing Coronation Street on Friday, and Saturday I'm in Morgan Freeman's Blues Club. It was called Ground Zero in Mississippi. And that was like, wow, this is just bizarre. And I've played there. Then we went to the River Fest, and I was just in awe of these like country legends. You know, Steve Earle has always been a massive fan of his, and to watch him do stuff was just brilliant. And we ended up playing in Memphis, in a place called Elvis Presley's Memphis, which is just off Beale Street. And I played a set in there. And being in Memphis around, I mean, Memphis is a fascinating place anyway, because that's where the crossroads of country and blues and soul and all that kind of genres of music all kind of hit together. And there was not so much, in my experience, there was not a lot of racist tension there. It was like, can you play? Yeah, how good can you play? Yeah, it's cool. They didn't care whether you were yellow, green, or blue with yellow spots, you know. It's all music based.
Yeah.
And I learned a lot about where the music came from and the way that country is, it kind of seeps into main music, and to this day seeps into main music.
Yeah.
You get artists now who put a song out, they stick a fiddle on it and call it country, which is not particularly true.
Mm.
So this was all happening. It was quite a crazy time. I was going flying backwards and forwards. I wasn't making any vast amounts of money. I was doing it because I'd got sober, and they told me that if you get sober, you can do anything you want.
Wow.
And I embraced that. I embraced that running at it. I thought, well, I want to do this.
Yeah.
I want to do that.
Yeah.
I want to be this. I want to do that. Because that's what I was told, and I believed it. And I thought, well, yeah, I can do it. I mean, I'm not saying to anyone out there who's listening to this who's struggling with a drink problem that, yeah, no, stop drinking and you'll become a country music star. Or
no.
That was all just a byproduct. What I'm saying is I got my self-confidence back and this can-do attitude. And obviously I was helped by the situation and the circumstances and the people that I knew got me into that situation. So the whole thing was pretty surreal.
Mm.
As I say, I was doing Coronation Street on a Friday and playing in the Mississippi on the Saturday. But I was just having a really good time. And then obviously Coronation Street, who had the patience of a saint, because why don't you do this story? Can't, I'm doing this gig. Well, we need you to do it. I can't. I'm not there. I'm doing this. And then, obviously, their patients kind of, and quite rightly and correctly, said, well, look, you know, you've got to make a decision here, what you want to do. And we need that house for other characters.
And, yeah,
and,
yeah, yeah.
And to this day, you know, I said, well, you know, I've got absolutely no, there's no criticism of Coronation Street at all, because in a sense they saved my life because they sent me to rehab.
Sounds like they're. It sounds like they're like a proper family.
Yes,
like,
over absolutely.
There. Like they're absolutely. Really, it seems like they've been really good.
Yeah, they were brilliant. They did. I mean, they took the American approach where they decided that the Americans actually do certain things very well, and one of them is rehabilitation of people, and especially in business and corporate, where they look after their people. They send them away to be, for rehab, and when you come back, you get a better worker, a better employee, and a better person.
Yeah.
And so I have absolutely no truck with Coronation Street or ITV. They saved my life by sending me to rehab. But as I say, all this is quite squeezed into.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
But otherwise, we'll be here all day. and the stories are great, great stories, but I can't tell them all because, as I say. So it came to a point where Coronation Street said, you know, well, we need to let you go. And this was another kind of wild moment. My wife and I, Claire, had been trying for children, and because of my somewhat rock and roll lifestyle, this was.
She'd been with you through all of this, addiction, and
absolutely. Yeah. And this was not going to happen because of my addiction and what have you. So we'd gone down the route of IVF, and on the very day. That we found out that we were going to have a baby was the very day that my boss called me in the office and said, Kevin, look, we're going to have to let you go.
Wow.
And he couldn't work out why I had this stupid grin on my face. You know, it's supposed to be in life, in Coronation Street folklore, it's the most devastating of your day of your life when Granada turned around and said, we're not giving you another contract.
Yeah.
In the scheme of things, that could be possibly the worst thing that could ever happen to you as an actor. But to me, it was like, well, you know. But again, this was this can-do attitude.
Yeah.
The glass is always half full.
Mm. You
know, which I've kind of carried on with me since, I mean, I've been sober now coming up to 20 years.
I mean, that's amazing. And well done on that.
And now I just, that's the attitude I have, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying I'm having the bad days where I'm getting annoyed. And
of course.
But you know, there's always a positive to look for, always.
Yeah.
So that was that. And then I thought, well, what am I going to do now? Coronation Street had ended. So I thought, well, I'll just, I like music and I like acting. Musicals seems to be the perfect marriage to that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So the first one I did was Rocky Horror. And Johnny Wilkes, God bless him. He said, well, come and do Rocky Horror. And I was the narrator. And it's the first time I'd ever come across, done a musical. And it's the first time I'd ever realised that it's a whole different genre. It's as different from Shakespeare to Panto because it has its own language. It has its own, it's different technique. It's a completely different beast. Where you have swings instead of understudies. I mean, I didn't understand what all that was about. And covers. I thought, well, what's that mean? You know, we don't have covers.
Yeah.
What's that? And I really liked it. I really liked the genre.
Yeah.
And again, I embraced it. I thought, well, let's have a go at this. This is cool. And I like the idea of being in something so big, because normally in a play, you've maybe got 10 people, but in the big musicals, you've got an awful lot of people. And I enjoyed that. And that one thing led to another, and then I went back into the West End again to play Amos Hart in Chicago.
Chicago, yeah.
And that was, again, that was just nailed it. And that was great because I was doing that. I mean, it was pretty mad. I'd finished whatever I was doing. I can't remember what I was doing. And then I went up to Manchester, and Katie Mae Kennedy, my first daughter, was born. I saw her born on the Monday morning, and then Monday afternoon I was in rehearsals for Chicago, and I opened 9 days later. kind of about, well, what's going on? You know, it was crazy. And then followed that right through, did that job. Then I started writing documentaries for Sky. I wrote about 3 or 4 series called Kevin's Spanish Capers.
Right.
For this the idea of the Costas in Spain and how it's great and everything, but if you just go a couple of miles inland, it's a different Spain. You know, it's a different total different story.
What made you want to do this?
I lived in Spain at the time. I was lucky enough to have a place in Spain, and there was a TV company out there looking for ideas, and I came up with that one. And that was very successful and ran, I think we did two series of that.
Yeah.
And it was very irreverent, you know, and it was pretty crazy and a lot of fun, an awful lot of fun to do. So we had little baby Katie with us at the time, and then I did Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, and I played the child catcher, and that's when our second IVF baby, little Grace, came along. So one was born during Chicago, one was born during Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, and I worked with people like Brian Connolly, who Brian is a personal hero of mine,
yeah.
Because I got on with him really well, and he was very encouraging and supportive. And I said, I really quite fancy doing what you do, because I'd seen him, and he's one of our best. I mean,
yeah,
he's a proper singing, dancing.
Yeah, acting. I know Brian from him. He did Strictly.
Yeah, yeah. So he's one of the best.
He's wicked, yeah.
Right? He's one of the best we've got. And so I used to watch him in the wings and learn from him. And eventually I got asked to play his part, which was Caractacus Potts.
Right.
So I'm the only actor ever to play the child catcher and Caractacus Potts. Should you ever be in a pub?
Okay. Pub quiz,
and that comes up, and he was again a massive hero of mine. I love him a bit, and there were many others along the way.
Mm.
So that happened, and then what else happened? And then loads of crazy stuff happened to me. I had two children. I was doing Panto up with Jade Goody, God love her, and.
Yeah.
And I got a call to go down to audition for We Will Rock You. It was going out on tour, the first tour ever.
So you still have to do full-on auditions for everything.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You've sort of done everything and everyone knows who you are.
You still have to audition.
Yeah.
So, and I don't mind that. I quite enjoy that.
Okay.
You know, in a sort of masochistic way, I suppose. and I went down and auditioned for that, and that was a cool one as well, because I was really tired. It was in between... three shows of Panto, and then a day off, another three shows. And I went down and I walked in this room, and there's Brian May, Ben Elton, and Roger Taylor. Oh no, Roger wasn't there. It was crazy. Roger wasn't there. I'll tell you why in a minute, because I sang the song that they wanted me to sing. And they said, I read the piece and said, thank you very much. I came out of the theatre, went to get something to eat. I got a phone call from my agent, they want you to go back. I wasn't well pleased with that because I was tired. I went back in, a bit bolshy actually. And it was explained to me that Roger Taylor had written the song, Days of Our Lives.
Uh-huh.
He'd written it and he couldn't be there and he needed to hear me sing it. And could I come back the next day? To which
right.
I said, no chance, man. I can't. I've got to do the Panto. I said in quite a stubborn and bolshy way. And then Brian May gets his phone out and says, sing it into this and we'll send it to him. So there I am singing Days of Our Lives into Brian May's phone. Which was Mike Dixon was on piano. And it was just, it was a great experience. And as I'm walking out, I turn round to them, and I won't swear, but you can guess where the swear word came in. I went, gentlemen, it doesn't matter if I get this job, because I will dine out on this story for years.
Yeah.
Out the building. And then again, you know, I don't think I'd got as far as the station, and my agent rang me and said, you've got it. And that started a very long, long association with We Will Rock You.
Yeah.
So I did the Years tour, which was great. You know, and Brian May came on and played the solos and things. And that was just, I mean, a kid from Wythenshawe.
Oh, my God.
Loved that. And then I did the West End for 2-3 years.
Wow.
And that was cool.
But I love that your attitude to that was like, oh, it was just a great experience. And you didn't even care if you'd get the job or not. Because, like, I think most people would be forgiven for being just finding it daunting as hell. And just being so nervous.
It can be daunting, but it's up to you, isn't it? I mean, how many other people get to meet Brian May in an audition situation?
But that's a great attitude to have.
I think it's the only attitude to have if you're going into auditions. You know, but auditions are just auditions. You know, they're not judging you so much. If you're right for the job, you'll get the job.
Yeah.
You know, it's just one of the... Well, that's what my particular...
Yeah.
Way of thinking, you know, if you can do it. I mean, I don't, a lot of people go, oh, it's stunt casting for this, that, and the other. I have no qualms.
Yeah, I was going to ask if, like, has that been a thing for you? Because people would know you from Coronation Street. Is it like...
Well, it's opened doors for me. Yeah. I mean, I have no qualms where you come from. What, but where your journey's brought you to. All I care about is if you can do the job.
Yeah.
If you can do the job for 8 shows a week,
yeah,
then fair play to you, you know.
Yeah.
I don't mind, bother me if you've come from a working man's club into the West End. You can do the job. That's all
yeah.
that matters.
Yeah.
So, you know, I have no qualms. And Coronation Street, yes, it's a double-edged sword. People say, oh, no, they have that attitude that soap actors, they can't act. They can.
Yeah, why do you think that is?
Like, I don't know. I just think they've got a bit of soapism.
Yeah.
They don't think they're very good. But I think most of the soap actors I know are brilliant because they do things that other people can't do. They learn scripts quickly with speed, accuracy, and then inject their own stuff into it. It's genius.
And have to go through, like, especially if you're there, you were there for 20 years, have to go through quite a lot of different sort of storylines and relationships with different characters and dynamics. It's not like even if you're considered a really sort of highbrow actor, I suppose, and doing like a Shakespeare play or something, you're still doing that same play.
Yeah, but that's
every
got
night.
A beginning and a middle and an end.
Yeah.
Which lasts, if say you're at the RSC, it's 2-3 hours long or whatever.
Yeah.
This your storyline in a soap opera. Could go on for months, if not years.
Yeah.
And you've got to balance that and work out, find your way through that.
Yeah. And do it quickly.
Quickly.
Like you've got to be ready.
You've got to be ready and you've got to think about it. You can't just turn up on a soap set.
Mm.
You know, you've got to think about, or think very quickly, what am I going to do here? And sometimes you make mistakes, which I'm a great believer, folks, if you're listening, making mistakes on stage, on the screen, that's what makes you a better actor. And even if this thing we talked about cracking on stage,
which
seems to be a big thing in musical theatre. I cracked. So what? Yeah. So what?
Yeah.
It's live. No, who's judging you? You cracked. So what?
Yeah.
You forget a line. So what? You know, it's live. You're there. Yeah. You're doing it. That doesn't define your whole performance or, in fact, your whole career because you cracked. And cracking, by the way, for those who don't know, is when your voice kind of goes a bit weird during a song and you go, which, you know, for me, I think that's part of it. It shows you're human and I think almost endears you to the audience almost.
Yeah. Shows you're human. Yeah. Like just be all right with being
who you are and what you are.
Yeah. Totally. Yeah. Do you feel like sometimes, say if you'd come into a role and people know that you are there, they know you as Curly Watts from Coronation Street, and because some people do have that slightly snobby attitude towards things like that, does that put more pressure on you sometimes to prove yourself?
I've got belief in my own abilities.
Mm.
And of course, for the first 20, 30 seconds, you get the rustling of programmes and going, I know his face and all that. And then if they're committed and you're doing your job properly, they forget all about that. What I like about the particular we're doing the show now, the show that we're in now, is a lot of people don't work out it's me until it's mentioned later on in the show.
Yeah.
And that, I get a buzz out of that.
Yeah.
Because my next entrance, they go, oh, it is, you know. Because
it is him.
It is him.
It's Curly. Yeah.
And I like that. You know?
Yeah, that's wicked. Yeah. What it's like the more that you're sort of talking to me and telling me all these stories, what's striking me is that, like, it doesn't feel like you ever sort of set out to be famous big star. No. It wasn't the intention, like, I am going to go forth and achieve and be this well-known actor or musician or whatever it is. You've just sort of, you knew what you loved. You knew what you loved doing. Yeah, and you exactly. just put energy towards that.
Well, when we were talking about the 70s and the punk revolution and everything, I think it stems from that. And I think I could maybe speak for Johnny. I don't think Johnny ever wanted to be the world's greatest guitarist or coolest man on the planet, although he was born cool.
Yeah.
We just wanted to do what we loved.
You know?
And I loved acting and I loved the idea of being an actor. I love the idea of the way it used to be, where, you know, rogues and vagabonds going from town to town, breaking hearts and one step ahead of the law. I love the romantic side of all that. I mean, obviously, it's not like that. It's hard work. But there was a certain element of that which I really cling to, or I still do, you know, especially when I was drinking, because it was that was a perfect kind of escape, and I loved all that. And no, I never ever wanted to be famous. Never came into it.
Yeah,
but, I mean, when I first got to Coronation Street, it was a great gig because I was at home. The fact that it would change your life forever never even crossed my mind.
Yeah, that's brilliant. That
yeah, it's good.
I love that.
I didn't even think of it as a professional career stepping stone either. I just thought, it's cool, nice character. Get a couple of weeks out of this. Get home. Get the washing done.
Yeah,
it'd be cool.
Yeah, and you just
I wasn't that
it.
Career minded at the time, and I mean, that's no bad thing. I mean, a lot of people now are career minded, and that is very good. You know, I wish to a certain extent I'd been that kind of savvy, but nah, I didn't care. I just wanted to do what I wanted to do and get paid for it.
Mm. And I suppose if it's something that you know, like with clarity, that this is what I love doing,
yeah,
that, like, then you're going to put a lot of energy towards it, and like you're going to work hard at it because you love doing it anyway.
Because it's fun.
Yeah.
And, you know, I like every aspect of this job.
Yeah.
You know, the touring, of course, it's hard, and being away from family, it's hard.
Mm.
But you get to see things. I've done things which I would never have done. I mean, I worked for Royal Caribbean for a while, and because I quite fancied that, being on board a ship doing a show.
Yeah.
And I love that. I love being part of the crew. And,
yeah.
You know, a lot of actors think it's a bit beneath them.
Yeah.
I loved all that. When they said, right, we need you to learn how to tip a life raft, you know, those big rubber rings, you've got to learn how to turn that over and get in a swimming pool and put fires out and... You know, and I loved. I really had a good time.
You weren't there going, but I'm a serious actor. I can't be working on this.
Oh, this is cool. You got to live in Miami for a bit, which was an eye opener. And then I got to go and sail around the Caribbean and the Med. And I got to see things. And you know, I went across the Atlantic a couple of times, done the crossing, and I thoroughly enjoyed that as an experience as well. Again, that could be a bit rough sometimes, but you know, you just got to think, oh, this is an experience that, you know, to like we're sat down now telling stories. I've got stories to tell.
Yeah.
You know, and I said, well, this happened when we were been in a hurricane once, and you know, and we lost everything above the deck one had just gone. We are down to two engines or one engine or whatever. We had to limp back to New York and
what?
Oh yeah, crazy stuff, man. Crazy stuff.
Oh my God.
Yeah, that was hairy. Yeah.
Jesus.
Yeah, that was really hairy. But again, I thought, well, you know, this is somewhat a story to tell.
Yeah, everything's just a story to tell, and everything's an experience and a journey. And
well, that's the way I try to look at things.
Yeah. You know? Yeah,
I don't always succeed. I can be as grumpy as the next person.
Yeah.
But I don't want to do this show. I don't want to be here. I want to go home and eat ice cream.
Yeah.
Yeah. But by and large, I have a good time.
Mm. But then if it seems like you always had that attitude towards everything.
Yeah.
You've certainly got that attitude now. Like, where would, if you don't mind talking about it, where did the sort of drinking come into it? Why do you think that sort of seeped its way in? And
I wish I could sit here and tell you that that the pressure of this business. That's not true.
Right.
That's just not true. I think being in this business, the process was going to happen anyway, I feel.
Hmm.
But being in this business just speeded everything up because I had money.
Yeah. Right?
I was young, I had money, so I had the ability to buy the things that I wanted to buy.
Mm.
I think it was going to happen anyway.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I was having a great time.
I mean, I do,
when people say, the pressures, of course there's pressures in this business, but
yeah, like
I didn't let them get to me that much, you know. That's why I was with the... I joined the Borderline for a while. I was playing bass I went out with a dance band for years because I just couldn't find, I hated music, I just didn't like what was happening with music, and there was no live music anywhere. And
you mean you hated the scene?
Yeah,
like, right.
Oh, I hated it. All that Stock Aitken and Waterman stuff was driving me crazy. So I was sat in an Irish club one night, and there's a band on called the Borderline, and I said, can I sit in and play bass? And they said, yeah. And I sat in and I didn't leave, I think, for about 4 or 5 years.
Right.
So we'd play Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday night. And I used to get in a yellow van, transit van, with the lads, who were still friends to this day.
Yeah.
And I'd just go around playing. I never got any money for it. I never got paid for it. I just didn't want to go to Stringfellows on a Friday night. It didn't appeal to me. I wanted to learn how to play live. It was the only circuit that was probably still going.
Yeah.
And so I was playing bass in a dance band every Friday, Saturday night. It was a proper band. We all had the same suits and everything.
Right. Yeah.
And it was great. And I just found release in that. Mm. And I think that was probably one of the kind of lifesavers that kept me grounded, was just being in this transit van with the boys. Mm. And I thoroughly enjoyed that. And I learned how live music works. And that training came in invaluable later on when doing musicals.
Yeah.
You know, the PAs that we use today are pretty highbrow compared to the six lads in a transit van and the PAs we used then. We didn't have a fallback. That was just a luxury. We just had to pitch everything the best we could.
Yeah.
So, and I think that is the best training you can get. It was just a strange experience. Again, another strange experience. I was Curly Watts Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. And Friday night at 9 o'clock or 7 o'clock, when a yellow van had turned up outside my house, I pick up my suit and my bass, get in the van, and we play all over the place.
Yeah.
And it became like a bit of a secret. The Manchester people are really good. You know, they say, you'll never guess who's a bass player in this band. Oh, Kelly Watts, get out. No. Well, why hasn't it been advertised? Why hasn't it? I said, it never is.
Yeah.
It's just like a mad secret that the bass player in this band is, and actually I got this idea off Jeff Hughes. Jeff Hughes used to play in a traditional Irish band as well, around the pubs in Manchester.
Okay.
And it was just the thing you did. I thought, this is cool. This is a good idea.
You're just doing what you wanted.
Yeah. So while other people are being photographed by the Paps falling out of their Stringfellows or whatever, and I was sat there having a nice pint, playing waltzes and foxtrots. Because we used to set everything was set up in, so we'd do like a half an hour of foxtrots and half an hour of waltzes, then we'd do the quick step.
And
that's what
that's
we
my
did.
Scene.
Yeah, exactly. You know, that's what we play all night.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's just amazing. You were just living out this life. Yeah, Coronation Street, yeah. Then playing in a band, just doing all the things that you wanted to do that made you happy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what I love then, just going back to what you said about, say, when you went into recovery,
mm.
is that you'd been told you can go and do whatever you want to do. Like, you can be whatever you want to be, do whatever you want.
All you've got to do is put down the drink, put down the drugs, and live your life. You're free.
Mm.
You're not tied. Everything I was doing was tied to a bar or tied to... I mean, I wouldn't go on holiday unless there was a bar or a pub or something.
It became habit more than anything.
But habit and addictive habit. Yeah, I mean, all I used to do towards the end was I had a local pub, which is the only place I felt safe in. So I'd go to the pub. And the other place that I felt safe on was in the van with the lads and on stage with the lads.
Mm.
Because I was going through this kind of weird stuff that addiction makes your world go a lot tighter. I just couldn't face the real world. Now, whether that's to do with pressure of being in current, I don't know. Mm. I try not to think of the whys. I think of, you know, what happens now. You know, I don't think of my last drink or my life as an alcoholic too much anymore.
Mm.
It's painful. So why would I? It's painful for me, painful for my family. And I have two beautiful children now who've never seen me drink. So, and touch wood. And that's a gift, you know. So, I think, you know, that's the way I look at it all now. I'm just, everything's a bonus. You know? And I'm very lucky. I've done the stuff that I wanted to do. And I've worked hard, and I've worked hard since I've come out of Coronation Street. I've not really stopped. I've toured the world and dragged my kids with me, you know.
Mm.
My children have been all over the place.
Yeah.
You know, they went to Singapore and they saw pink dolphins and they've been to New York, and they've been to Disneyland a couple of times, and they get on when I'm doing Panto. They get to meet all the princesses, and they got to fly in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. I mean, yeah. It's not, you know, that's not the be all and end all of parenting, but
it's lovely.
It's great for them, it's and stuff yeah. that they'll remember.
Yeah, because I mean, I haven't talked about it that much myself, sort of out loud to a lot of people, but I know we've had a couple of conversations when we've been in this cast, and that you know, I'm sure not to the same extent as what you've gone through or what a lot of people have gone through, but you know, I've had my own battles with, you know, with drinking too much, and for me, I wasn't living just the life that I wanted to live. And that's why I keep going back to like you doing all the things that you just love doing and putting energy towards that. And I felt my world go tighter and tighter, and I was getting really sad, and I wasn't sure why or what was happening. And when I stopped drinking, and I was speaking to a few people about it, and I also went on this course, an American guy called Tony Robbins, who does stuff, and I did this 4-day course, and he was talking about like when things are going wrong, everyone has the wrong mindset of you think that you have to be something, like I've got to be something, like something different to what you are.
Yeah.
Whereas he was trying to get everyone to focus in on just getting back to who you are. And the stuff that you want to do, and don't compare yourself to anyone else. Like everyone's going through their stuff and what they want to do in their life. Just get back to who you are and do what you want. And it's kind of the same thing as you were saying. Like once you just stop doing this, just put the drink down a second. Yeah. Get back in touch with what it is that you want. And I've felt myself do that, like sort of over the last year, and things have got an awful lot better.
Yeah.
But the mindset shift was not like, oh, I've got to try and be this. It was just, right, what do you want? Go and do that.
Yeah. But like, and it's as simple as that, really.
Yeah.
But we complicate it because we're humans.
Yeah. And we think we've got to achieve something. Yeah,
these old sayings like the grass is always greener, there's a lot of truth in that. You know, people say, oh, the grass is... But actually, the grass is always greener.
Mm.
You do think that, oh, you know, oh, that I wish I could do this, I wish I could do that. And it's in the advent of the media and social media, particularly people who you don't have that life. I wish, you know, you look at photos of people online, you think, well, yeah, that's a lie, though, isn't it?
You're
all happy.
Yeah, that's the thing. We're all projecting this sort of
this image,
perfect, wonderful life on social media,
and it's rubbish.
Yeah.
I mean, my life isn't perfect. Of course it isn't. Mm. I'd like to spend more time at home with my kids. Of course I would.
Mm.
But the reality of it is that, you know, I work hard. Well, I do with my charity stuff as well, which actually, to be fair, my wife does. We put Kennedy Street together, Kennedy Street CIC, which is a charity which we help where we can.
Mm.
Yeah, and my wife runs that, so someone's got to go out and do the bread and butter stuff, and that's the deal that we made. And plus, my wife actually had the luxury, a very rare luxury these days, of just bringing up her own kids. You know, didn't have to work.
Yeah.
But the deal was that, you know, I might be missing for 6-7 months of the year. And that's fine.
And she deals with that okay.
Yeah. Well, the kids haven't grown up with three heads, and they're very level-headed. And, you know, they understand. They love theatre. They love the arts.
Yeah.
They're very clever. They're not the kids, you know. Obviously, they have their moments like all kids, but they're two beautiful girls.
Yeah.
Who are very level-headed. And dad's an actor, and that's the end of it, you know.
Are they likely to... Reactors, or
I hope not. I told them, and I'll tell. I gave this the same advice to my children that I gave to a lot of young people that want to get in this business. So this business is great if you're near or at the top. You know, my kids have seen me in nice hotels and nice dressing rooms, and you know, and cars coming to pick you up occasionally when you work for TV. I said, well, it's not like this normally. If you are not near the top or at the top, then this doesn't happen.
Mm.
You know, it's a struggle.
Mm.
And I give that advice to anybody.
Mm.
But if they want it, they want to be in this business that bad. That's certainly, it wouldn't have mattered to me.
Yeah.
You know, I just wanted to do what I like doing.
Yeah. And that's it, isn't it? Because like, it is a struggle at times. But the thing that we keep coming back to, if you love it, then you love it anyway.
Of course you do.
Like, if you hate your job that's in an office or something and it's a massive struggle, then that's a real problem.
Hmm.
But if you love what you do, there'll be struggles that you have to contend with, I suppose, but you just do it anyway because ultimately that's doing the thing that
you
love.
It's the other old saying, isn't it? I mean, if you do a job that you love, you'll never have to work a day in your life.
And, yeah.
Can we have a member of Vocal Cruise take the iron out, please? That's take the iron out. Thank you very much.
There you are, folks. Life theatre. Yeah. But that's for me. That's my, yeah. That has been my, I mean, you know, life isn't rosy a lot of the time. It's a dreadful time sometimes. I mean, addiction was not the best. The best thing I've ever been through. In fact, we're awful. I lost myself. I lost. Mm. I lost an awful lot. I didn't know who I was.
Yeah.
I don't. Whether that would, I say I tried to separate the business that we're in and addiction, because I think that would have probably happened to me anyway.
Yeah.
If I worked in an office, for example, I still wouldn't have been very happy with what I was doing, and I still would have lost myself somewhere along the way.
Yeah.
I think I was just to have that addictive personality.
Mm.
You know, my drug of choice was more.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
One's not enough.
Yeah.
You know? And I'm still got it. You know, I've still.
Yeah.
I go and buy, I see a pair of pants that I like. I don't buy one. You know, I'm like, I'll get two
okay.
of them.
Yeah.
Because you never know. They might run out. What am I going to do? They might run out. They might not have my size. What am I going to do? Oh, I like them shoes. I'll buy two.
I get it. Yeah. Totally.
Yeah. So it's still there.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a shocker for it.
Yeah.
You know, it's just because. And all the same colour. Because that's the colour I like. You know, he's still around.
Yeah, and one thing I did want to mention was, like, there, a few weeks ago, there was a moment when, like, you said you had a bit of, like, your anxiety before the show, and it really hit you.
It very rarely happens. They touch wood these days, but you were there, you saw it. I just had this dreadful, dreadful self-doubt. So anxious. Not stage fright. I mean, stage fright is bad, but I'm talking beyond stage fright. Stage fright is like Premier League, right? Anxiety to that level, we're talking World Cup.
Right.
World Cup, Champions League, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
It was intense and a dreadful feeling, and I've not had it for quite a while. And the way I used to deal with that was to drink or to use, because I could drink and I could feel that anxiety slip away, and it was self-medication. It was I'll have a drink and it'll go and it did, and that is that's the best thing ever. You think, I found the answer to my self-doubt and my anxiety and the fact that I don't particularly like myself sometimes if I drink. I'm suddenly the bee's knees, but because I've got an addictive personality and my drug of choice is more, that is where it all got out of hand.
But I
went through this, you were there, you saw it, and I just, what am I going to do? And I just had to think through it. I had to concentrate. I had to tell people.
Yeah.
That's
the key.
The key for me was telling people. I'd tell everyone. I went around the whole cast going, I'm really anxious today. I've got to tell someone.
Yeah.
I'm really, really anxious.
Yeah.
Now, probably they couldn't, well, you know, they could care, but they've got their own stuff to deal with. But the actual act of me voicing it to another human being lessens it somehow.
Yeah.
And by the time I told the entire cast and probably half the audience if I'd had my way, it started to subside. And then I went to one of the self-help meetings. I personally, this is for me, I go to AA. I went to a meeting and I went, oh, you'll never guess what happened to me, but I had this really bad anxiety attack. And that's the way I do it. I'm not saying AA is the only way. And there's many routes across this swamp of anxiety and addiction. For me, that works. So I went to a meeting and managed to get it all out, and I felt loads better. But as I say, there was a shock because I've not had that for quite a while.
Yeah.
And that can be anything. Anything can bring that on. It's a bit of tiredness, a bit of homesick.
Yeah.
You know, we've been on the road, and we've been on the road for a year, and it can get, as you get older, it can get a little more tiring. It's not such a big adventure anymore sometimes. And that, there's nothing wrong with that. That's just being human.
You know? Yeah. And I think, like with any of this stuff, talking about it is
That's the key.
Is the absolute key. And if, you know, that's why I think all this stuff that's coming up more and more common now, like people talking about mental health issues or addictions or like any of this stuff and anxiety, it's getting more and more normal.
I can take a small problem, right?
Yeah.
And I put it in my head.
Mm.
Don't tell anyone. It's just in my head. And by the time I finish with that small problem, it's the size of Belgium.
Yeah.
I've massaged that problem out of context completely.
Yeah.
And it's huge.
Yeah.
And in fact, it isn't. But because my head deals with it, my best thinking is not brilliant.
Mm. Yeah.
My plans usually involve, we'll end up in disaster.
Right.
So I try to sort of balance that by saying, what do you think I should do here?
Yeah.
To someone who is like-minded.
Yeah.
And I love talking to other addicts and or addicts in recovery or even out of recovery, because we all think the same.
Yeah.
And people won't say that. You know, people get, wow, I think like that.
Yeah. And you find that because of what they've been through and what they are going through, that they've actually had to do a lot of sort of soul searching.
Yeah.
And they probably know themselves a lot better than 99% of people,
yeah,
because they have to get in touch with what's going on for them, yeah, and so they really start to understand themselves.
Yes, it's no bad thing.
Yeah, yeah, and that's sort of going back to your situation is sort of a beautiful thing that will have come out of, you know, I'm sure you sort of at the time obviously you think you can do without this problem in my life, but then it's brought about such an understanding of yourself And like you described it as a gift, the fact that you got back to you and what you wanted.
The gift, the big gift is that nothing is insurmountable.
Yeah.
I mean, there's consequences. Of course there are. But you can deal with them without turning to a prop. And it's painful. It hurts because we don't like it.
Mm.
But you're going to have to because that's life. Every time I've come up against a problem I've in the past when I've been drinking or using, I've just run away from it.
Yeah.
And it's still there,
mm,
but now you've got to deal with it with a hangover or coming down.
It's like a credit card, isn't it?
It's like,
I'm going to drink, it'll go away. I can use this credit card, pay for it,
yeah,
but then you got some interest coming.
Yeah, you've still got to deal with it at some point. And I don't like it. I still don't like it. I don't like dealing with stuff. I hate it.
Yeah.
And I will leave it to the last minute, but I will deal with it eventually. Yeah.
And you know that you can.
Yeah.
Because of what you've been through. Yeah, that's amazing.
That's it.
That's really cool, actually.
Yeah. And we've gone off the subject a bit, but
as I knew that we would. But
I think it's cool, and I hope it's interesting for anyone who's listening. Just, you know,
absolutely,
you're struggling. You know, basically, folks, if you are struggling, open your mouth. It's the only way.
Just talk about it. Yeah. Then, because I don't want to take up loads, I feel like I could do like 10 episodes with you because there'd be so much to talk about. We probably will do a part 3 at some point in the future.
Absolutely.
Because you've got so many stories and like you've lived such you've got so much experience of life.
Yeah. Well, I have. And I, you know, and I'm not saying that to be sort of self-promoting.
No.
It's true. You know, I have been across the ocean in a hurricane. You know, I did play in the Riverfest with top country stars. You know, I did get signed by Simon Cowell. I you know.
It's just an insane life.
Yeah.
Have you written a book?
Yeah.
You have?
Yeah.
Is it out there? People say, I might
get
this.
It's out there, yeah. It's called, it's called Kevin Kennedy, Street to Recovery. See what I did?
Yeah, Street.
But that ends.
I'm going to read this.
That ends when Coronation Street kind of ended. And so much more has happened since then.
You need to do another one.
Yeah. So much more. Overcoming fear and being free and saying, yes, I want to do this. That's great. But then fate has a way of handing you those things.
Yeah.
It's like getting a job in the theatre.
Yeah.
The best bit is when the phone rings and says, yes, you've got it.
Yeah.
After that, it's just all grief. Because you think, can I do it? Can I do it? And you go through all the kind of emotions, stood in the wings, and you're going, what am I doing? Why am I here? I can't do this. Why am I? And waiting for someone to tap you on the shoulder and go, right, okay, no, you're not in the right place, Kevin. You're not good enough for this.
Yeah.
You're going to let all these people down.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
You have to go.
Yeah.
Right. And that little voice is strong.
I hate that voice.
Yeah. Is it? But the other one
is exhausting.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. But you've got to. And the other one's going, you can do it, you can do it. And the other one's going, no, you can't.
Yeah, and that no, you can't one is louder.
Yeah.
Like that's louder it is, it and more aggressive. Is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I got through that. Guy. I've been through. When I took over doing Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, it's one of the most difficult tracks you can do. It. You're never off. And you've got to dance and do the old bamboo. And the first half a killer, man. I was thinking, what am I doing?
Yeah.
What possessed me? What on earth did I, how did I think I could do this? You know, you've been watching Brian Connolly and the rest of the guys do that. But they're miles better than you. Why am I here?
Yeah.
It's too late now.
Yeah. Got to get on with it.
Got to get on with it.
Yeah.
But the totally feeling of satisfaction of when you've done it is better than any drug or any alcohol you can buy.
Yeah.
The buzz that is, wow. If you could sell that, man.
Woo. Yeah. Yeah. Doing what you love and overcoming challenges within it.
Yeah.
Like the biggest buzz in the world.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Is that, like, before we wrap up, is there anything going forward, like that specifically you want to achieve, like any part you want to play or anything musically, or maybe it's not that, maybe it's just you just want to carry on being able to do what you love, or
I'm still ambitious, you know. I still sit there in the theatre and think, I could do that.
Yeah,
I can do that. I can do that. Why can't I? Why am I not doing that? Why am I not there? Yeah. I've still, and that'll never go, and that's always been with me, and that's not a bad thing. Like, ego is not a bad thing, ever, if it's channeled in the right direction.
Yeah.
Right?
That's a necessary part of it.
Of course it is. I mean, you know, people say, oh, he's got a big head.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, well, good for him.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's self-belief. Yeah. And you've got to have a little bit of that.
We hate it in this country, though, don't we, for some reason?
Oh, you know, if someone does well in this country and gets himself a Rolls Royce or a Bentley, people like to run a key down it.
Yeah.
In other cultures, they go, good for you.
Yeah, well done. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I mean, there is a bit of that. And we do like to build people up to knock them down. Mm. Yeah. You know, but for me going forward, I have no idea. And I like that. I think that's quite exciting.
Yeah.
I have no idea what I'm going to do next. No idea. I'd like to do Strictly.
Yes, mate. Yeah.
That'd be a challenge.
Future Strictly winner.
I'd love to have a go at that.
Yeah.
Just for the 60-year-old blokes out there who think it's all over.
Yeah.
No, it's not.
Yeah.
Come on. Yeah.
Sign him up.
Well, hopefully. You never know.
Yeah.
And just, you know, I've enjoyed this tour. It's been a great experience. Meeting your good self has been an absolute joy. I'm going to see Mickey Mouse with the family, which Brilliant. Is going to be, I'm really looking forward to that. I've got a panto, but I don't think I'm at liberty to say where yet.
Okay.
But, and then after that, I have no idea.
Yeah.
We'll see what comes my way.
Yeah.
And, you know, whatever it is, I will rise to the challenge. There'll be some tearful moments, I'm sure, where I'll go, I don't want to do this.
Yeah.
I want to go home. But, you know, that's all part and parcel.
Yeah. Well, I want to say thank you as well, just for doing this interview, but also for just how you've been with me on this tour. Like I came into this tour with that guy on the shoulder going, you can't do this. This is out of your comfort zone. This is not what people are used to seeing from you. Yeah. You're a dancer. You're not a singer and actor. Or people are going to think that you've just got the job because you're on Strictly and you're no good at it, and people are going to judge you. And why did my voice just crack? Yeah, and why am I not singing like Jennifer Hudson tonight? Yeah,
God save us from thinking too much about what other people think of
us. Oh, yes. Yes,
God
exactly.
Save us from that, because that's the killer.
Yeah.
Because we listen to it.
Yeah.
And it'll tell you lies.
Yeah.
That voice just tells you lies. You're not good enough.
Yeah.
You shouldn't be here.
Yeah, but you were like straight from the off. My first week in Glasgow, and we had them changing rooms opposite each other, and you kept coming in and going, are you all right? Like, is there anything you want to go through, or anything you need, or, you know, like, are you okay? You feeling okay in yourself? Or if there was something happening on stage, like say something had gone wrong, I don't know, a light wasn't working or something, you'd be straight over like,
Don't worry about it.
There's a light, don't work. Don't worry about it. It's not your job. Ignore it.
Well,
you crack on.
Well, that's what I like to do.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
I like to pass that information on.
Well, it was like,
because people did it for me.
Valuable to me.
Like, you know, well, thank you.
Yeah.
And but believe me, people did it for me.
Yeah.
When I was first in this business, in the West End for the first time when I was a kid, I was like, so my eyes were just like saucers all the time. And people, you know, who come up to me, actors, go, listen, it's okay.
Yeah.
Don't worry about this. It happens or whatever. And I used to give myself such a hard time when I on stage, if something had gone wrong on stage or I'd made a mistake, the whole show was ruined for me. If I made a mistake in the first act, I just wanted it to be over.
Yeah.
Now that's changed. I just go, you've made a mistake, it's gone.
Yeah.
Get over it and get on to the next bit. And that's probably one of the best lessons I've ever learned is just, you know, just ride it out.
Yeah. Yep. Just ride it out. Keep cracking on.
That's it. Pleasure, mate. Thank you.
Cheers, mate. Thank you so much for this.